From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Alyssa Block.
And I'm Robert Siegel. For the past 2 days, NPR's Frank Langfitt has chronicled the lives of North Carolina furniture workers who lost their jobs to China. Well, today he takes us to China to meet some of the people who got those jobs. It's a journey that spans 2 years with many twists and turns. Frank Langfitt begins in North Carolina with one of the laid-off workers.
Bill Curtis watched his job slip away piece by piece. He cut cloth for sofas at Broyhill Furniture. Over time, he noticed more cloth arriving at his factory from overseas. Then, Broyhill began slashing his hours.
Work just started to dwindle. The more we saw leave, the more containers we saw coming in, and we knew that's where our jobs went.
And where were the containers coming from?
China.
Do you have any idea what someone who does your job in China makes an hour?
I have no idea. I've seen some pictures of furniture factories over there, and it's the closest thing I could think of to slave labor from what I've seen.
Slave labor. I wondered. Curtis's furniture job was among more than 300,000 that disappeared from the United States this decade. A couple of years ago, I went looking for some of those jobs in South China. I found them in Dalingshan. Furniture factories sprawl across the city. One of the biggest is called Lacquer Craft. One evening in January 2008, I waited outside the factory's back gate. Right now it's 5:30, it's the dinner time break, and hundreds of workers are pouring out. They're wearing the same blue jackets, and they're riding bikes and walking, going to stop off and get something to eat at restaurants. Inside, they build furniture for most of the major American brands. Including Broyhill, Bill Curtis's old employer in North Carolina. One of the Chinese workers I met was Zhao Sha. She prepares furniture for painting. Bill Curtis made more than $15 an hour. Zhao earns less than 70 cents an hour. But Zhao doesn't consider herself a slave. She says she's fortunate. Before working in the factory, she farmed a tiny plot of land in southwest China's Sichuan province.
We planted rice paddies, wheat, and corn. We ate what we planted. We never made any money off it.
I chatted with Zhao in the apartment she shares with her husband. They sleep on a box spring next to a DVD player and a small TV. Squalid by American standards, the conditions are a step up from Sichuan.
In a factory, you don't have to work in the sun. That's the best thing. I prefer working here. At least I get paid. At home, nobody paid me.
Zhao is among 4,000 workers at Lacquer Craft. An executive there, Hawk Cho, showed me around one afternoon in a golf cart. We came upon a stack of lumber that stood three stories high. I asked what kind of wood it was.
Baiyang.
Baiyang.
Baiyang mu.
Baiyang mu is white poplar?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Baiyang mu is the biggest.
That's the majority of our wood. It's the strongest, and it comes from around the American-Canadian border.
That's right. The company imports wood from North America, cuts it into furniture, and then ships it back across the Pacific.
There are a lot of exports to America, but some containers come back empty, so the price to ship things back in them is relatively cheap.
On my visit 2 years ago, South China was suffering from a surprise labor shortage. Instead of begging for jobs, as they once did, furniture workers could pick and choose. Workers like Chen Hong. He's 24 years old and makes $330 a month. Chen bragged he could command that wage anywhere.
If we go out looking for work, we can certainly find jobs like this and get them at the same salary. We have a lot of friends asking us if we want to work in other factories.
But all that was about to change. Back in America, housing prices were falling, so were furniture sales. Becky Song was a manager at Creation Furniture, a small company in Dalingshan. When I met her in January of 2008, Creation had already closed two factories. Song warned of worse to come.
If there is a recession in the United States, of course, Americans' purchasing power will decline and there'll be fewer orders. Factories won't be able to survive and they'll have to lay off people. Probably many factories will have to close.
Anyway, stock market murdered today.
Tracks show that U.S. foreclosure filings hit a record 1.5 million in the first half.
This is a panic, and this is fear run amok.
Becky Song's worst fears came true. The housing boom that fueled Chinese furniture factories collapsed, and Americans stopped buying. Last month, I returned to Dalingshan to gauge the damage. I'm back out in front of Creation Furniture. The place is abandoned. There's a metal security gate across the driveway. Front door of the office is strewn with an old mattress, a bunch of broken desks, and dead plants. The only person here is a security guard. I asked him what happened. He said Creation Furniture went bankrupt late last year. I also went back to Lacquer Craft, the firm that makes furniture for Broyhill and other North Carolina companies. I caught up with Hawk Cho, the executive there. He told me that in Dalingshan alone, more than 100 plants had shut down. Another factory manager said up to 400,000 workers had lost their jobs in the region and returned home to the provinces. Zozo Xin is one of the survivors. I met him one evening in the city's central square. Factory workers and locals blow off steam here, dancing each night amid the palm trees. Zhou said his factory cut hours until half its workers left.
They never say directly, we want to fire you. They would just tell you, you can still work here, but we have very few orders and very little work. Many people can't bear it. Then they would just quit.
Zhou is in his early 50s. He says, at his age, unemployment is just a matter of time.
I'll lose my job soon. It's not possible to have a career here. You can't have a job for life. The boss can just fire you when they don't need you.
Hawk Cho of Lacquer Craft says he learned a powerful lesson from the recession. Don't depend on the American consumer. Cho is now focusing more on the Chinese market, but he says that will take time to develop.
Chinese people have a bad habit. They're comparatively frugal. They can use one piece of furniture for 10 or 20 years. Americans are much more wasteful. We prefer the way Americans consume.
In the meantime, Cho says his factories and others in Dalingshan will survive. Things are getting better. In recent months, orders from the U.S. have been picking up. And once again, Cho and his factory are looking to hire. Frank Langfitt, NPR News.
Instead of ho, 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 this season's joyous cry is cheap, cheap, cheap. Retailers have been slashing prices to lure customers, but they also have been careful not to pile up huge inventories in case recession-weary customers refuse to buy. NPR Senior Business Editor Marilyn G. Wax joins us to discuss this week's showdown between bargain-hunting shoppers and profit-hungry retailers. Welcome back, Marilyn.
Good morning, Leanne.
Well, I don't know about you, but my mailbox has been stuffed with ads for holiday sales. My papers, newspapers are larger than normal. Are the price cuts that we're seeing for real?
Yes, they really are. This past week, we got a new government report on consumer prices, and it showed that pretty much across the board, retailers have been pushing down on prices. Now, gasoline did jump up last month, but when you take that out of the numbers, it looks like consumers are seeing pretty darn good prices. And, you know, one company especially, Walmart, has been so aggressive this year. Back in September, they announced that they'd be selling these brand-name toys like Barbie dolls and Transformers and things like that for $10. But just in the last couple of days, they said, nope, we're going down a little more. So, Leanne, now you can go out and get that Barbie fashionista doll you've been looking for just $8. That kind of price squeezing, you know, keeps pressure on everybody. So now Gap jumped in this weekend. They said that they'd be cutting 25% off of their regular price merchandise.
But explain, I mean, how are stores able to cut prices and make money this season? I mean, will they make any money?
They're certainly hoping so. They say part of the strategy is going to be just to keep those inventories so lean. They want to stock their shelves just enough to get you in the door, but not to have a whole lot of stuff left over after Christmas. And here's another key strategy. They've been really insisting that the manufacturers drop their wholesale prices, that Chinese, really all of the Asian manufacturers, have cut their product prices 10, even 30% this season.
So American shoppers are actually benefiting from Asian price cuts.
Yes, but, you know, the pressure on prices doesn't just extend to overseas manufacturers. We've seen a lot of heavy-handed tactics on with American companies. A couple of weeks ago, Costco, for example, told Coca-Cola that they wouldn't carry any of their products unless they lowered wholesale prices. So they, I mean, how crazy was this? They actually put up signs in the store saying that until we can provide our members with this product at competitive prices, we're not prepared to sell it. So last week, the two companies finally hammered out a deal, and we've got Coca-Cola back in the stores in time for Christmas and New Year's Eve parties. But I really think that little drama just underscored how tough negotiations have been this year on wholesale prices.
Sounds as though consumers are the big winners this season.
You know, if we think of ourselves as consumers, then yes, you know, we should really be happy to see inflation in check. But, you know, we're not just consumers. We're also workers. And to take advantage of those bargains, you need to have some income. The problem this year is that, you know, if you work for one of those suppliers, forget the Christmas bonus and you're not going to get a raise this year.
So we know shoppers are determined to get bargains. Retailers need profits. So at this point, what do you know about how it's all playing out?
You remember, Leanne, you and I talked about this early last fall, that retailers were putting up their Christmas decorations early. They wanted to give us, spur us to do our Christmas shopping. But people didn't take the hint. This past week, Consumer Reports put out a poll that showed that as of December 6th, 4 out of 10 adults said they hadn't done any shopping of any sort for the holidays. And the poll also showed that average families were planning to spend about $700 on gifts this year, and that's down about $40 from last year. So we know that shoppers are cutting their spending a bit. They're planning to hold out for last-minute bargains. But then this weekend, we've had rough weather in a lot of parts of the country, and that means some of those last-minute shoppers may never make it to the mall. But still, we've got retailers saying that, in general, they think they're going to survive because they're squeezing those wholesale suppliers, they're pushing their online sales, and they're tightly controlling their inventories. But in any case, I got to get to the mall because I want to see for myself what's happening.
All right, well, drive carefully, and
okay.
I hope you find some good bargains. Marilyn Duax is NPR's senior business editor. Thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
Big retailers aren't the only ones struggling. It's been a tough year for many small businesses, too. And with 2009 drawing to a close, many business owners are about to get hit with huge tax hikes in the form of unemployment insurance. From Miami, NPR's Greg Allen has this report.
In Florida, unemployment benefits top out at just $300 a week. But for someone out of a job, the money can be a godsend. Congress extended jobless benefits as part of the stimulus package and is now considering passing a second extension. In Florida now, nearly 700,000 people are receiving unemployment benefits. And for employers, it comes with a cost. Employers like Kevin Rusk, who makes and sells beer at Titanic Brewery and Restaurant in Coral Gables.
This particular one here is Captain Smith's Rye. That beer is the only beer in the state of Florida to ever win a World Beer Cup award. So I'm really proud of that, and we sell the schnockers out of it.
Rusk is one of the thousands of business owners statewide who soon will be receiving a notice that his unemployment insurance premiums are rising. In fact, skyrocketing. The minimum rate for employers with few claims, which was $8, now is leaping to over $100 per employee. That's left business owners like Rusk with sticker shock.
In my business, if I said I was going to increase the price of a burger, I can increase it 5%, 10%, you know. They didn't do that. They increased it 1,200%. And that's just a sour pill for most people to swallow.
Florida's unemployment rate is just over 11%, above the national average. With so many people out of work, the state's unemployment fund, which a year ago had a $1 billion surplus, was quickly depleted. A few months ago, Florida began borrowing money from the federal government. And at the same time, an automatic trigger kicked in, dramatically increasing premiums paid by business owners. With 30 employees, Rusk's annual premiums rose from a few hundred to more than $3,000. Unemployment insurance has suddenly gone from negligible to a noticeable expense, one that he says may affect business decisions.
I can't say that I wouldn't hire another person, but I'll think a little harder than I would have before.
That's the impact economists and policymakers are worried about, that this rising cost of unemployment insurance will cause business owners to tighten their belts just as the recession appears to be easing. Rick McAllister heads the Florida Retail Federation.
Businesses are beginning to feel a little better about the light at the end of the tunnel, and we don't want them to think now that that's a train. It's a psychological defeat that would be a jobs killer and a recovery killer for the state of Florida.
No one is suggesting that unemployment benefits should be cut, but Florida's Retail Federation is asking legislators in Florida to put the tax increase on hold for at least a year while businesses get back on their feet and the economy improves. Because of the automatic trigger that kicked in raising unemployment premiums, Florida is one of the first states to feel the pain, but it soon will have lots of company. About 25 states have depleted their funds and turned to the federal government for loans, borrowing some $15 billion. The Department of Labor expects those numbers to grow to include 40 states and some $90 billion in loans before the jobless picture improves. That's all money that will eventually have to be paid back by business owners through higher unemployment insurance premiums. Rich Hobby is with the National Association of State Workforce Agencies. He says in many states, the crunch will come in 2 years when it's time for the states to begin paying back the federal loans.
2011 will be when most of the states that have borrowed will be facing an increase in their federal unemployment tax, and that, coupled with the increases in state unemployment taxes, will really get the interests of employers, and they'll start to advocate for change.
Currently, the federal government loans to the state's unemployment funds are interest-free. As the states come to grips with this problem, pressure is likely to build on Washington to extend the program or make other concessions, shifting at least temporarily the rising cost of unemployment insurance from businesses to the federal government. Greg Allen, NPR News, Miami.
You're listening to NPR News. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Leanne Hansen. The Saturday before Christmas, known as Super Saturday, is one of the biggest shopping days of the year, but the huge snowstorm that walloped much of the East Coast this weekend made a mess of things for retailers and shoppers alike. Here's NPR's Allison Keyes.
The Fashion Center at Pentagon City is usually packed to the rafters at this time of year. Yesterday? But the wicked weather meant a clear field for shoppers like Pamela Savoy.
The stores weren't very crowded and Metro wasn't crowded at all.
Wearing bright red rubber boots against the snow, with her smiling husband in tow, Savoy was on the hunt for bargains.
That's why we're here. Seems like the merchants are trying to sell. So, as usual, putting off shopping till the last minute has actually worked out, even though you are in a rush.
We're from Ohio, and so this is regular weather for us. It's great.
Despite the blowing snow and stranded cars outside, folk like Noreen Palmer and her friends from Columbus, Ohio, found the weather exhilarating and just perfect for shopping.
I got a red Baron hat for my son, so he's going to love that.
But right in the middle of the holiday cheer came the grinchy news that the snow was all too much for the area's public transportation.
The Metro will be closing today at 1 o'clock.
Reagan National Airport shut down completely yesterday in Washington, D.C., while hundreds of flights were canceled or delayed in many places, including Philadelphia and New York. Virginia State Police reported hundreds of crashes and disabled vehicles since Friday, and Amtrak trains in the Northeast were delayed by the weather as well. Even the Smithsonian museums are closed. Back at the Virginia Mall, stores like cosmetics retailer Sephora took the hint, since many of its employees took buses or trains to get to work.
We're closed. Sorry.
That was a little sad for Randy Mack of Virginia, who was looking for a particular shade of fancy lipstick.
It's been nice because there's nobody here, but apparently half the stores aren't open anyway, and they're all going to be closing now because of the Metro, so it's a little frustrating.
The mall shut down for the day at 4 p.m., not good news for nervous retailers, but Pam Brown of Virginia Beach put the whole day in perspective.
I mean, it's Christmas, and what do you expect on Christmas time?
No.
A white Christmas.
Plus, not everyone was stranded by public transportation. Noreen Palmer and the Ohio group knew just what to do.
We hired a limo, and we gave him a nice tip, so he's coming back to get us.
Sadly, they did not offer NPR a ride. Allison Keyes, NPR News, Washington.